Shrink Wrap Radio number 573. A Jungian confronts racial and sexual injustice in Mississippi with Tony Caldwell.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
Today, my guest is psychotherapist Tony Caldwell, licensed clinical social worker, who is in the last stages of preparing to become a Jungian analyst and who has been doing pioneering community work in Mississippi dealing with issues of racial and sexual injustice. For more information about Tony Caldwell, LCSW, please see our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Tony Caldwell, licensed clinical social worker. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, Dr. Dave. It's great to be here.
And you're a listener as well, am I right?
I am. I've literally listened to every episode of your podcast.
Whoa!
I spent a lot of hours listening to your voice, so it's a little surreal to be talking with you in person.
It's always exciting to me when somebody who's been on the listening end, you know, when we bring you in through the screen, through the magic of the screen, here you are. You've stepped into the same room practically. So that's always exciting to me.
Yeah.
And to have accompanied on your journey, because you're in the process of becoming a Jungian analyst.
I am. I've been in that process since 2012. And I just returned from the Interregional Society of Jungian Analysts fall conference in Minneapolis.
So as a longtime listener, you're probably aware that I put Jungian analysts kind of on a pedestal. And so so I think that's really cool, too, that I've been part of your journey unknowingly as you were headed in that direction. Maybe you could just tell us a bit about what it takes to become an analyst and what you need to do to finally finish up.
Yeah. So I started that process in 2012, and that involves joining a local seminar, and there are several of those across the nation. I'm part of the Memphis Atlanta seminar, and those are 9 weekends a month for training. You have to stay in your personal analysis and also do supervision during that time. And, you know, I'm getting to the point where I'll take exams and move to the next stage, which is control stage. And things start changing at that point where you move towards the final steps of that process.
So the control stage, is that where you are being the analyst for a patient and you're being supervised in that process?
There isn't an increased amount of supervision, and you leave seminar at that point to focus mainly on the clinical aspects of the work.
Uh-huh. Okay. So about how much longer do you think you have before?
Oh, gosh. You know, this is a lifelong journey, so who knows?
Probably doesn't make sense even to look at it that way, right? You're on the journey. And
right. I've tried that approach, and, you know, psyche and timelines just don't really work together very well. So I've given up trying to think of it that way, and it's really freed me up a lot. But, you know, if I had to guess, I would think within the next 3 or 4 years, I'll be moving towards completion.
Okay. Okay, so I was struck to hear from you and to hear about the work that you're doing with racial diversity, sexual discrimination, oppression. How did these sorts of issues become so prominent for you?
From personal experience in childhood, for race, I grew up in a rural sort of marginalized neighborhood. I was the only white kid my age in the general area. I have a younger sister. There were 2 other white kids in the neighborhood around her age. But so I didn't grow up knowing what it's like to be black, but I grew up with a front row seat watching the intersection of race and class in rural Mississippi as an observer. You know, I almost feel like I didn't get investigative reporting as a child and didn't know it. So I have a lot of stories from that angle that I've been telling in various capacities through writing and through town halls and workshops. And then, you know, just bearing witness to other people's stories. There's so many stories out there, and it's really amazing what dialogue can create, you know, as far as a shared experience that arguments or speaking through the internet, you know, social media and that sort of thing, you know, usually tears down conversation, but getting in the same room really opens up dialogue in new ways that sort of hit the heart level, and we drop down out of the head enough to have a new shared experience.
Yeah, well, if stories come to mind during the course of our conversation, be sure to sprinkle them in, because as a Jungian, you know that story is very important element of the
psyche. Yeah, one comes to mind. So growing up, the visual, what I saw when I looked out of my bedroom window is a visual that stuck with me and sort of driven this work throughout my life. And what I saw was a cemetery. So the view outside of my bedroom window was a cemetery that started as a Confederate cemetery. There had been a battle right there. And a soldier had died, and they buried him there and made a memorial. And later, you know, there's a monument and the flag and the whole thing, a gated area. And that's the centerpiece of the cemetery. And there's a line of trees that stretch north to south that sort of intersect that monument. And it divides the property into east and west. And so what I saw from my side was the east side. And this was the white cemetery. And it, you know, there was elaborate stonework, markers, benches, gazebos. It was just, you know, very nice. And what my neighbor saw, so I'm bringing my neighbor into the story, and I'll connect him in a second. So my neighbor that I played with out in the street, now in the yard, you know, on a daily basis, he saw the cemetery from the west side, and these graves were more rustic, handmade. A lot of them have the names of the deceased written in the wet concrete with fingers, you know, and so it's very, very much a different scene. A lot of those graves were hand dug, so the ground's uneven, and you just see this really ugly, appropriately ugly display of how the past is still present. And so what he saw and what I saw were two different things. And so we would play on a daily basis, but we never crossed the threshold into one another's homes.
Now, was he white or black?
He was black.
He was black. Okay.
Yeah. So I never went into his home. He never went into mine, but we played out in the common areas and in the street, riding bikes and playing basketball. But there came a time later in life where we crossed the threshold. And so he had come out of federal prison for selling crack cocaine. And I was doing transitional counseling for the federal prisons. And when I looked at my intake paperwork, I saw a name I recognized.
Wow.
A few minutes later, he stepped through the threshold into the office, and we were in the same physical space for the first time. And our conversations were very different than when we were children playing out in the common areas. Yeah. And so we talked in some ways about our different experiences, and that centerpiece that stood between my house and his being that cemetery with the Confederacy being the centerpiece of it. And you know, it really symbolically, the difference in quality between the two sides of that cemetery really symbolizes the difference in quality of life between the races. And, you know, it's sort of that's what I've had the opportunity to bear witness to throughout a lifetime. And, you know, there's a lot there that needs to be shared with the larger world.
Do your family roots go way back in the South?
They do. I know very little about my history on each side, you know, past two generations. But, you know, I think it goes back pretty far. On my mother's side, there's a good bit of Native American heritage. Obviously, didn't get much of that. But, you know, on my dad's side, I believe people were originally from Europe, from England, and came to the area. My mom's side's a mixture of Native American and Irish.
Okay. You know, the Jungian analysis in some ways always seems very kind of rarefied, you know, very intellectual in some ways. And so how does the Jungian perspective, I mean, you're doing a lot of work that's down in the trenches, you know, right, down and dirty, right? And so it's interesting, that's one of the reasons I really wanted to, was looking forward to speaking with you, is that juxtaposition. What is it that the Jungian perspective brings to your work on race and on sexual diversity?
Yeah, yeah. That's a great question because, you know, this work does tend to be pretty Eurocentric, just given the roots of it. But also, I believe this work gives a voice to the inner world that we all share, no matter what our thoughts of about what our external or biological heritage is, that we all, you know, share in the fact that we have a conscience, even if we don't have access to it at some points. We all have a sense of consciousness to some degree, and we all share a collective consciousness, and as well as an unconscious and a collective unconscious. And so I think some of the dynamics that I've seen play out socially, when I was introduced to the language of the personal and collective unconscious, it's explained a lot in the shadow, you know, the personal and the collective shadows, that really open up this work and really gave me language to talk about experience that just wasn't there before.
Well, you've spearheaded a number of events related to community healing. And you did work in Tupelo, Mississippi, and Oxford, Mississippi. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah. So a colleague of mine, Dr. Jandel Crutchfield, she's an African-American female. And she and I, you know, during our days, I also teach at the University of Mississippi. So we were colleagues teaching there. And at any given point, there was just a wall between us physically. You know, our offices were next door to one another. Our classrooms were next door to one another. And so at any given time, the only thing that was physically between us was a wall, but we never really connected relationally. And there came a time where we were both engaged in a conversation that drew out a mutual passion around privilege and race and racial violence and police brutality, where we connected and we started talking about the shared passion. And so in Tupelo, there was an incident where there was a white police officer that shot and killed an unarmed black man. And this was during the bloody summer where this was, you know, the conversations around this were being raised because it was happening in so many places around the country and being called, you know, and talked about in the media. So we decided to have a town hall to discuss this. And, you know, it's this grassroots. Five people could have shown up, but we had over 200 people show up.
My goodness. How was it publicized? Was there a flyer? What did the flyer say that drew people?
We use social media a lot, and we use local media, newspapers and television stations. And we even had interest, you know, come from Memphis, which is a couple hours away. But it really, the fact that someone was doing something really generated a lot of interest. And we quickly found out that there's a lot of people who have a lot of thoughts and feelings and passions, but don't know where to put it or how to connect. So this gave us an opportunity to come together.
Well, what did people think they were coming to?
We build it as Together Tupelo, which just means coming together to talk about what's going on. It was almost like a family powwow, if you will, for the community. So we came together.
And both races came?
Absolutely, and it was multi-generational. And so we started out, one thing I like to do when we start out conversations like this is break through the denial that's sometimes there, especially for those of us who are not marginalized or haven't had that experience. And so what I started out with was the words from the Apollo mission in Houston, we have a problem, you know. And so if you look at the transcripts, of that conversation, it is Houston, we are having a problem out here. So the people on the margins, the people that were in the most danger, the furthest from home or home base or safety, were saying, hey, there's a problem out here. And of course, the people at Mission Control are going to say, OK, I believe you. Let's talk about this, instead of, oh, no, you don't. You know, sometimes it's the response when there's issues of diversity. Sometimes the majority is quick to say, that's not really a problem. Get over it. Work through it. You know, something along those lines. But there's a denial. So to open it up to say, you know, if we want to know if there's a problem, we need to ask more instead of talk more. We need to listen more. And so we came together to listen and to bear witness to one another's stories. And Dr. Crutchfield has this great exercise she does on privilege where you're basically doing math problems and you don't realize what you're doing or what you're getting into. So you get deeper into this conversation than you, which used to be, but then you're stuck there. So anyway, she gives this list of, it's your privilege score, but it measures the conditions that you inherit at birth. You know, did you have two parents in the household? Did both parents have a job? Did anyone in the house have a college education? On and on and on, you know? So at the end of that, we split up the room by our scores, and we end up in like six different categories. Well, at that point, the lowest group and the highest group come together and talk about it.
Uh-huh.
And that's a real game changer. You know,
I can imagine.
It's very different than arguing through Facebook or something like that. It's face-to-face, bearing witness, and just acknowledgement. And I think that shadow work is bringing things into consciousness that we'd rather not look at, things that need to be addressed, and, you know, letting truth move up into our heads so it can then move down into our hearts.
Was the discussion civil the whole time, or was anger an issue?
Yeah. We had one lady that, you know, sort of had an outburst, but once it was processed, it was sort of like we were saying some similar things. There was as much common ground as there was, you know, sort of a contentious feel to it once we talked for a while. And so I think, in retrospect, I'm glad that that happened because I think it gave an image of what that looks like, and whether that's within an individual or between two people or between groups.
To kind of have a chance to demonstrate, hey, we can work this through. We can deal with it.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, rationality can go a long way.
Somehow this strikes me as courageous on your part. And, you know, in the best of all possible worlds, courage wouldn't even be an issue. But it is an issue in today's world, I think. Did it feel like an issue for you? Did you feel like you had to summon something up to go ahead and do this kind of work?
Yeah. You know, I don't feel like it's an option. You know, I would, it's a little uncomfortable using words like calling, but I do think that my life experiences have put this on me in a way that it's not really optional. And I've had lots of support from friends and family and a lot of partners who have, you know, emerged in this work. And so it's really been beautiful, but it has been challenging. You know, part of the downside in some ways, I guess for the ego, parts of the downside to taking a stance is that you lose people. You know, you lose connections. And sometimes, you know, especially in religious communities or among more conservative friends, the price of standing out is that you no longer fully belong.
Mm-hmm.
So that, there's been social consequences for our family in that way. You know, my wife joins me in this work and we raise our child along our lines of belief, and we talk about social issues and, you know, and try to model, you know, ways of living and ways of addressing things for him. And so that does, you know, it's hard to be the life of the party when you're talking about such heavy topics,
you know,
but yeah, I mean, there's consequences, but we happily endure that. And, you know, it's sort of like I was telling a mentor of mine, she's an older African-American female. And, she was saying something about the courage of this work. And I said, you know, nothing that I've been through can compare to what you've been through, you know, and continue to go through. So, you know, it's real easy to not get caught up in thinking about that because you just see the suffering of other people. And but you do get a glimpse of how certain groups of people are treated when you stand with those groups of people, because you start getting treated in a similar way. And I've most especially experienced that standing with the LGBTQ community in this area. There's a sense of us and them, and if you stand with them, you're no longer part of us. And so, you know, that's relationally for me, that's been the most difficult part of this work. The scariest thing that happened is when we first did the Together Tupelo, and this was following the police shooting, and there was an ongoing investigation and a lot of racial strife within the city, which, you know, it's usually calm because it's not talked about, but those conversations were really stirred up and really divisive. I had a police investigator ask me to lunch, and instead of going to lunch, we pulled over on the side of the road, and I feel like I was being recorded, but I know I was interrogated and intimidated, and then dropped back off in my office. So, you know, I really feared consequence there. And, you know, that conversation with him really opened my mind and my eyes to what I think, to a new definition of white guilt, because I feel like that's part of what he was bringing to the table that was being projected onto me. And later on, when we had the event, he showed up in plain clothes. And when the rest of the people in attendance were sitting in the lower level, he sat in the balcony alone, just staring at me, you know. Wow. And so that was scary. You know, there was
clearly there was intimidation attempted there.
And, you know, Lord knows my imagination could take that and run with it. But but it was definitely scary.
And was there any difference between your experience in Tupelo versus Oxford?
Yeah, it was quite different. Oxford is a university town. University of Mississippi's here. And so it was a much more of an academic crowd, more socially justice minded. It was a lot more, I think, preaching to the choir in a way. But the turnout, I think we had around 300 people show up for this thing that we basically advertised on Facebook and by word of mouth. And we had some beautiful conversations and made a lot of connections. And one of the best things about that is we made a list of attendees. And so now when anybody that's connected to this newly formed circle does anything along the lines of addressing race, we can let each other know. So it's network building, community building.
Okay. Are there action steps associated with this? Like, it's totally significant what you're doing, even if it doesn't go any further than what you're doing. But it might be a tool to try to make some things happen in the community. Are you using it in that way?
Oh, yeah. Those meetings are definitely first steps. And so the next question is always, what next or what now? Mm-hmm. And so there's only so much one individual or a couple of individuals can do to keep that work going in addition to our own personal lives and professional lives and everything. So part of what we've done is set up racial diversity groups that we can meet in and encourage other people to do that, to sort of plant those seeds and take ownership of that and spread that model. I recently, with a grant through the Kellogg Foundation, did one of these racial diversity groups with another colleague, Sheila Neighbors. And so it was another dynamic where African-American female and myself co-led this group. We brought together 36 individuals in the Tupelo area, 18 white, 18 black, anywhere from 16 to mid-80s in age. And the equal neck of the woods, the racial makeup is not equal. So when we have an equal amount of people in the room, it really changes the conversation. And to hear multi-generational stories, we had a lady in the room who had a childhood memory of a family member being lynched.
Wow.
You know, we had young children, or not young children, but teenagers telling their stories of being young children and recognizing racial difference, sort of leaving the garden in that way by force because of the ways they were treated. And trying to interpret that and understand that ways that their interactions with police officers have been different than the average white child or teenager. And, you know, the Mississippi Delta is an area where there's a lot of slavery and a lot of really bad things happened there. And then once slavery was over, there was a lot of white flight. Now there's just a lot of poverty, a lot of African-American poverty, lack of opportunity, poor schools, and a lot of social conditions. And we had several people in the group that lived in that area during the time of desegregation and had so many different stories about how aware they were of what was going on, or the perspective from which they experienced that. And to come together and talk about, to compare notes, basically, and share these stories was amazing. I mean, there's a lot of tears, a lot of anger, a lot of denial breaking down, a lot of hugs. I mean, the full spectrum of emotion was in the room. And so it was tense enough that it was real, but it stayed contained.
Wow.
You know, it stayed safe. And we, one of the most touching things, it was a little less dramatic, but one of the most touching stories that came out of that was an older white lady that was paired up, because part of this is we talked in groups, but we also paired off into paired interviews between one party from each race. And so an older white lady and a younger black lady did their paired interviews, and these were all recorded and coded for research. Older white lady says, "I don't like to go to the movies when I know a lot of black people are going to be there, because, you know, black people like to talk in the movies and it's distracting, you know?" And so she was just being honest about her experience and sort of what was going on in her. And so this younger African-American female said to her, "Can you imagine being so disempowered that the most power you feel like you have is when you can be loud in a theater and sort of agitate a little bit?" And
that certainly shines a different light on it, because, you know, that's something that I've observed as well, and I've never thought about it that way.
Right. Yeah. And so, you know, my inner work and this outer work, just they're constantly informing one another.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as I'm working on division externally, I'm working on division internally, whether it's between me and myself or me and other people, you know, I mean, it's just there. So the inner work and the outer work always inform each other.
Now you shared that you're working at the intersection of psychoanalysis, social justice, and spirituality. And in that context, you shared with me that you're a Christian.
Right.
And it sounds like Christian work that you're doing, but not many people practice that kind of Christianity in my experience.
Right. Yeah. It's very interesting. You know, what Christianity means to me seems to be very different from what it means to probably the majority of Christians, at least in my area. I always feel when I have these conversations, like people around me or in this area are going to think I'm being overly critical of this area. But really, all I can speak to is my personal experience. And I don't know Christianity in Minnesota or Vermont. I just know it in Mississippi. You know, that's where I live. So if I'm just speaking from my personal experience, it does seem that, you know, Flannery O'Connor, the writer, Southern writer, talks about the Christ-haunted South. And I feel like in some ways that's where we live, that describes 2017 as much as it did the South during her time. That there's this feeling or this talk about or this belief in this original wholeness, but we're not really walking towards it in a lot of ways, not trying to bring it about. And, you know, William Faulkner says to understand the world, you must first understand a place like Mississippi. And that's, you know, that's part of my work. Is to try to understand what's going on around here and what's going on inside of here and how those two can inform each other and how that work can be simultaneous. There's a guy named Taylor Kitchings who wrote a book. He's a Mississippi author. He wrote a book a couple of years ago called Yard Wars. And in it, one of the main characters is processing racism with his son. And his son has encountered racism for the first time. And this is a white family. But, you know, the white kid's going, okay, there's a difference here. What's going on? I feel the social, you know, difference that's making things between Brent and I weird. And so the dad says, you know, it's sort of like one day God took the best of what's good in the world and the worst of what's bad in the world, stirred it all up, and dumped it out between Memphis and New Orleans. And I think that's part of, I think, the shadow. I think that's language for the shadow and the gold in the shadow that we see here in this particular time and place. I think it gives poetic language to that.
Yeah. I've always loved the Southern writers. You know, you mentioned Faulkner, and there are just a number of others who are just have such a gift of language.
Right.
And I forgot where I was going with that. That was supposed to go somewhere. Oh, it was going to go towards, I'm remembering To Kill a Mockingbird, for example, a book and a movie that was very impactful for many people. And it painted a certain picture of the South, of Mississippi at that time. Mm-hmm. How has Mississippi changed, if at all? What does the 2017 Mississippi look like compared to 50, 60, 100 years ago?
Yeah. I think, our politics here are regressive. Whether it's our governor or our senators, each one's an individual. But for the most part, you see a lot of regressive action here. We just passed an anti-LGBTQ law. It's the law of the land here now in the state of Mississippi. And it allows business owners and also therapists to refuse service to people who identify as anything other than straight.
Wow.
Yeah. And so that to me is very regressive and very, very scary. I was invited by the Southern Poverty Law Center to work on an amicus brief to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in the federal courts to try to fight this. And my part of this was to describe how this is a really bad move for the mental health community. There's a lot of Christian counselors or counselors who are Christians who will say, hey, I don't want to work with you based on my faith, and I can't imagine being at my worst, being suicidal, coming to someone to unload this and get help and being turned away.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I have a son who's gay and, he is a member of the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus. Okay. They just did a tour of the South.
They just came to Jackson.
I don't know if you got word of that or not, but that was just in the past month. I was nervous about this, them going down South to kind of witness, if you will.
Right.
And turned out it was a magnificent experience. Mm-hmm. That. They were really well. I was afraid some crazy would, shoot or something really bad would happen. But
right,
thank goodness nothing bad did happen.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's always the fear. My experience so far has been more along the lines of just not talking about it. It's been more my experience than violence. And so I hope I can keep saying that, because that is something I'm proud of about our state, is that fear of violence. I haven't seen it manifest yet. I know it happens, but as far as in my personal experience around these issues, we held a town hall with the Human Rights Campaign, and I moderated that, and it's where we invited LGBTQ individuals and couples and transgender people to come be guests, and I moderated the town hall, and the community could come, and we could just get to know one another. It was called the Love Your Neighbor Campaign. And so my big fear there, because, this area is a weird area, so the American Family Association is based in Tupelo, and so they're possibly the biggest anti-LGBTQ group in the nation, and very conservative evangelical Christian organization. And so their headquarters is less than a mile from where we held this town hall, and my fear was that there would at least be picketing, but luckily there wasn't. We had a beautiful night, and Toyota sponsored it, and they loved it, and they put more money into keeping that work going. So there is progress being made. It's too slow and it's not enough, but progress is being made. And I think the more that people that have a voice for this work come out, the more others of us come out. I think it's similar to being gay in a way, the coming out part. If you're progressive in some way, when you come out, other people are inspired to come out as well, and you form community around that sharing and that that sense of being on the same page in some way.
I was just mentioned Southern writers, and you let me know that you're an avid writer and that you've got an upcoming book, United We Stand: The Role of Spirituality and Community Healing. Mm-hmm. So tell us about that.
Yeah.
So you just joined the ranks of a Southern writer.
I hope so. That's my goal. It's a step in that direction. So this is a larger book. Jandell Crutchfield and I that did the Together events, we have a chapter in this that we're co-writing. And so it's stories from across the nation of people who have done social justice work that arose from their spirituality or their faith tradition or their religious convictions, basically. So ours both, our shared work came out of our Christianity, you know, and our Christianity is very different. She comes from a more conservative background. I'm more of a progressive Christian. But we've never talked about that because it doesn't matter. We're too busy building something together to mess with differences in theology or interpretation. It just, you know, we're doing this work together in a way that's just so important that why bother?
Yeah, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
You mentioned white guilt at one point, and probably, I would imagine, you've probably been accused of coming from a place of white guilt. Is that true?
Right, yeah. Yeah, it's funny, the police officer I was talking about earlier on Facebook, he had referred to me as Mr. White Guilt at some point. <I'd seen. laughs> Yeah, so something really got triggered in this guy. So I'm glad it was that trigger and not a gun trigger that was going on.
Yeah, really, really. But you say that there's white guilt is a real phenomenon, but yes, different than what people usually think of.
Right, right. So whenever I've ever heard the word white guilt, and I would challenge listeners to test this, whenever I've heard the terminology white guilt, that's always a defense. You know, the accusation is that there's some inappropriate emotional burden based on past events that we're not responsible for or something along those lines. Mm-hmm. And that mm-hmm. somehow we've watched too much CNN or something and we've developed a disorder, you know, that's called white guilt. And so whenever I hear this language and when I feel it coming, these accusations coming at me, what I always realize is that there's projection going on here. So if I think about, okay, let's reverse this. What is the accuser guilty of? I don't know the answer to that, but how do guilty people act? Defensive, accusatory, you know, really invested in blaming, shutting down the conversation, stopping the conversation, changing the topic, somehow being defensive, angry. And so I never hear people use the word white guilt when they're not in that state of mind. And I think the main thing that I've come to is that when someone's acting this way and saying these things, it's a way to pathologize white compassion and white empathy and white acknowledgement. And if mm-hmm. you take it away, it's just a way to try to pathologize the heart, to caring.
Yeah.
Because opening our eyes to these things, you know, sort of the, you know, language among the younger folks these days is if you can see social injustice, you're woke, okay, which is just playing for awaken. Your eyes are open. The scales have fallen from your eyes. You can see reality in a different way. And, you know, there's consequences to that. And a lot of people don't want to cross over into that because it's heavy and it's difficult and it's painful. And you have to figure out what to do with all that.
So I heard somebody use woke. I don't remember where it was, but I immediately got that the way it was being used is that it's about a kind of awakening, which is, you know, a very large concept in a way. And here it is at the street level, just in a very succinct.
Yeah. I think that's just more evidence of how the two worlds cross over. You know, the mm-hmm. analytic world, you know, awakening is seeing things as they are and bringing it into consciousness. And I think a lot of the strife we're seeing nationally right now and politically is that we're all seeing things as they are. We can't deny racial violence. There's too many videos of it. We can't deny police violence. There's too many videos of it. So we have to figure out what to do with that. And we either jump over into defense mechanisms or we wake up in a new way. And you can see two camps along those lines, whether we're willing to acknowledge what's going on and take some shared responsibility for it or whether we're not.
Yeah. You know, speaking of psychological concepts, you say that race relations mirror attachment issues. How so?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think at the macro level, part of what I do in these together meetings is talk about us as a human family. And divorce is not really an option. You know, there's no other planet to move to. So, you know, we're stuck together. So what are we going to do from there? And if you just use a family systems approach to that, you can use a psychoanalytic approach. You can use a lot of approaches, but basically what you'll come down to is this dealing with the tension of opposites. You know, and in the union world, we talk about that a lot. You know, how do you put things together? How do you stand in the middle? You know, how do you stay in the cooker when things get heated and let transformation happen? But, you know, as far as family dynamics, I think a lot of times you see scapegoating, target children, a lot of these other phenomenon happen. You know, if you speak up or speak out, you might become the scapegoat, the target child. You know, I mean, if you look at the kneeling phenomenon with the NFL, Colin Kaepernick is a target child at this point.
Yeah. You
know, scapegoated. If we put our hands on him and put our sins into him and chase him down and kill him, we don't have to deal with our stuff. You know, so it's there's some dysfunctional family dynamics going on within the nation. And, you know, until we own it, we can't even really look at it until we own it. You know, I mean, I think that's part of the way that we get it backwards. Sometimes we think we have to see something and then own it, but in some ways we have to own it so that we can look at it in a new way, a more three-dimensional way, see our part in it, how we're complicit, how we benefit from certain structures. And a lot of times, you know, in power dynamics, who wants to give up power to someone else who may turn around and then they'll have it and you won't? And what's the point, you know? So this theme of sharing and trust is just central to the whole mess.
Yeah. How did you get involved with LBT? I don't always remember all the letters. LBTQ?
Yeah. It keeps growing. Yeah. The most recent one I saw was LGBTQIA. But, you know, I'm...
What was the I and the A?
I'm 2016 right now. I don't know. So I'm staying with LGBTQ.
Okay.
For now, anyway. You know, I'm always having to update my knowledge and skills in this area because it's a growing area. You know, I had a cousin growing up and an uncle. And it was two different stories. My uncle didn't come out until after he had been married for 32 years, I believe. I could be wrong on that, but somewhere around that time. So, you know, been married with the child the whole time. And that coming out was very different than my cousin, who came out more as a teenager, and they had very different experiences. And you could see my uncle benefited from fitting in or blending in or hiding socially. And my cousin went through a lot of the social consequences that happened when you come out at an early age. You know, a lot of abuse within the family, within the community, beatings, and just treated terribly, you know? And so my mother was woke, you know, and that's, you know, that's why I can see things, because she taught me how to see them. Mm-hmm. And she always had a heart for the underprivileged and the underdog and the marginalized, because she knew that experience herself. You know, she had a very hard life growing up. So she on the heart level, she knew how to have empathy and how to see things. And so, you know.
And that really helped to shape you.
Absolutely. Yeah. Every bit of who I am in this area came from those early experiences, not just seeing the world, but having my mother interpret me to the world and the world to me in ways that made sense of this. And also mentors. You know, I had a mentor in middle school, African-American female, and I was going to honor her at Together Oxford, and she died a few days before that. But she really mentored me through adolescence in a lot of ways. And so you know, one of the things I say is between that experience and my experience of my cousin, who later on, he's been in a same-sex partnership for over 30 years. And so all I've really ever known since I was maybe 15 or no, younger than that, I don't even know. But anyway, for a long time, almost as far as memory goes back, is them as a couple. And they've always, when I was in college, you know, always feeding me and just, you know, being a great, great family members to me. So So what I always say to get down to the root of that is that sometimes if you love people before you realize you weren't supposed to, it's too late. You're inoculated. You know, you've had an experience that you can't undo. Yeah. And if we would help our children have those experiences early, experiences of connecting and loving and being loved by other people, whoever other people are, whether it's along the lines of race or class or sexuality or whatever, you can't, it's hard to undo that.
Uh-huh. So what's your advice to listeners / viewers about how they could deal with some of these issues that you're dealing with in their own lives, their own communities?
Yeah. First thing I would say is take it inward. You know, what's going on in here? What's going on in me? What's triggering me? What's bothering me? Bring it up into consciousness. You know, put it into words, write about it, talk about it, whatever you need to do, but find language for your experience so that you can find a way to process it and deal with it. But the most important thing, I think, is acknowledgement, you know, and that's part of acknowledgement on the personal level. On the social level, I think intentionality. So acknowledgement and intentionality. And by intentionality, I mean, find someone who's different than you and engage them and say, hey, I want to learn. Be a student, you know. In the Zen tradition, they call it beginner's mind, you know. Just be a student. And there's so much discomfort around that. You know, I don't want to be offensive, or I don't want to appear stupid, or something along those lines, some kind of inner talk that's not productive at all. Mm-hmm. So to just, you know, cross that threshold, get in a room with someone and say, tell me who you are and I'll tell you who I am. And we're so alike on so many levels just because we have a shared humanity that the differences as a problem fades away, but differences as something to celebrate emerge. You know,
You know, we live in such a segregated world, it occurs to me that probably many people don't have that on both racials. I'm thinking of the racial divide right now. Mm-hmm. On both sides of that divide, they can be pretty separate worlds of people not really knowing people on the other side, not being in social situations where that's likely to happen.
Right, yeah. And I think that's one of the things in Mississippi we've tried to cross. Jandel and I have also done work that's interreligious, interracial work. So we were invited in by an Episcopal priest to do work with the clergy of the town of Tupelo. So from every different denomination and all racial backgrounds. And the diversity in that room was more difficult to navigate than the racial diversity in the town because, you know, theology there was a lot of boxes in that room. And so the work that Jandel and I do is about spirit, and it's hard for spirit to breathe in boxes. You know, it's wind, it's breath, it goes where it will. That was difficult to navigate, but some of the productive work that came out of that was that African-American pastors, by and large, sent the message loud and clear that we, the white citizens of the area, need to listen, not talk, but listen, you know, and that trust, and trust happens when there's prolonged communication and prolonged relationship. And so that's been our work since then, is to try to make that happen. But to go back to your original question, yes, we're very segregated, and at no time more so than on Sunday mornings in the South at 11 o'clock. You know, our congregations, there's interracial congregations here, but for the most part, they're pretty racially divided. And I don't know that that's always necessarily by intention or choice at this point. I think a lot of it's just comfort level, you know.
Yeah.
And family history and proximity to your house and, you know, just all these factors that aren't necessarily where people are thinking, hey, I want to make sure I isolate myself from people different from me. But it is still happening either way.
I think comfort level really is a term that captures quite a bit, you know, of even what we would call prejudice is, hey, I'm comfortable in this situation. Don't rattle my cage.
Right.
Why would I want to do that?
You know? Right, right. You know, there's, it's hard to make people, you just can't make people care enough to get uncomfortable. And I think that's part of the challenge of the work is how do you help people find their desire to be uncomfortable? And Jung says there's no coming to consciousness without pain. And if growth and healing is on the other side of pain, sometimes the work, whether it's in the analytic room or whether it's, in a town hall meeting, is how do you help somebody even have the experience that they want to go through the pain to get to what's on the other side, if it's optional?
Yeah.
But when that doesn't happen, you have stunting, and I think a lot of what we have is collective stunting. We're developmentally delayed when it comes to empathy and compassion sometimes. And I think that language of special needs is something that we really need to use when talking about Mississippi, because in so many ways, we're a special needs state. That means we need extra special care and attention and time and investment. We're always the last on list of measuring poverty, education, all the bad lists were on the top, all the good lists were on the bottom.
Yeah.
And that doesn't describe our people or who we are as citizens of the state. What it describes is the social conditions that we're wrestling with.
Yeah.
And a lot of it's the sins of the fathers and all that. But, it's if we are truly a family here, how do we take ownership of the brokenness here and help one another figure it out and not just say good luck for that over there as long as it doesn't impact me?
Yeah. Well, I think the work that you're doing is so inspiring, Tony, and really am pleased to have had this opportunity to speak with you. I wonder if there's anything more that you hope to get in here that maybe you didn't get a chance to say?
Oh, gosh. Let me think. I think that's pretty much it. I guess if I have a couple of minutes left, I'll just use it thanking you for having me and for the service you provide, because, as someone from the analytic world, to be able to listen to interviews with analysts and just, gosh, talk about diversity. Just scroll through your mind.
I do strive for diversity.
It's in my subconscious at this point, because I listen to your podcast a lot going to sleep. I'll wake up and it'll be a few podcasts later, and I have to listen to them while I was sleeping and have to go back and re-listen or something.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. Well, pleasant dreams is all I can say, or growthful dreams.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for the use that you've made of Shrink Wrap Radio, and it's great to now have you be a guest here. So, Tony Caldwell, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio, and Godspeed in your work.
Thank you. And if anyone wants to check out my writing, TonyCaldwell.net.
I'm hoping that my voice sounds better to you on this interview than it did on the previous one. Last time, I blamed the gravelly quality of my voice on inhaling too much smoke during the wildfires around here. When I shared that with my wife, she said that she thought I was getting a cold. I disputed that, saying, "I've lived in this body a long time, and I know what it feels like when the cold is coming on, and this is not a cold, it's the smoke." I'm now eating humble pie because not long after that, I started sneezing like crazy and my nose dripping like a faucet, and I've had to concede that, indeed, it was a cold, or at least it was a cold complicated by smoke. Since I'm talking about my public persona, I can't resist commenting on the YouTube version of today's interview. I spend so much time sitting in front of the computer that my physical therapist really reminded me that it would be better if I were to set things up in a standing position. So I was able to do that for this interview, but I hated seeing myself on camera when I reviewed the result. I don't exactly have a tiny nose, but somehow the camera angle gave me an embarrassingly dominant schnoz. I thought I had transcended vanity, but I'm going back to doing the interviews in a sitting position. I don't know about you, but I'm really impressed by the work that Tony is doing there in Mississippi. I feel compelled to say that he's doing God's work. As you heard me comment during the interview, I do think it takes considerable courage to stand up against the various forms of bigotry, especially when you're vastly outnumbered. You might recall Tony mentioning a group exercise on privilege, and he made some reference to math as he was trying to explain it. I have to confess, I didn't really get what he was talking about. However, Sylvia Mendoza, listener and my social media superhero, sent me a couple of links to YouTube videos demonstrating group exercises designed to dramatically highlight differences in privilege. In the two links that she sent me, a group leader is directing a large group of young people to either step forward 2 steps or to step backward 2 steps, depending upon their answers to a series of questions. Questions such as, did you grow up with both parents in the home? Have you ever felt unsafe showing demonstrable affection in public with your partner? Did you ever attend a private school? Have you received free college tuition based on something other than your sports ability? And so on. In one of the two videos, the group began in a line across the auditorium holding hands. But as they responded to the questions, individuals had to move either forward or backward, and so the chain of hands being held was broken. Sylvia Mendoza noted that the parallel to that in real life, differences in privilege tear people apart. Rather than attempt to give you the YouTube URLs here, let me suggest that you do log on to YouTube and do a search on privilege exercise. You'll find a number of examples. This is such a powerful exercise that I know if I were still teaching at the university, I would definitely work it into one of my classes. I think just watching it on YouTube brought the concept of unearned privilege more clearly and powerfully into my mind than I had previously been able to admit. Well, at Sylvia's suggestion, I shared the YouTube link she sent me with Tony. He just now replied via email, and here's what he sent. I quote, "Those look pretty different from what we did, but definitely similar thematically. What we did included a short questionnaire with a total possible score of 32, and then segregating the room by score. In Tupelo, most of the people with high scores were white, and most with low scores were black, and the middle was the most integrated part of the room. It really put the focus on the conditions we start with, and then for personal responsibility. And then it ended by saying privilege isn't a bad thing, but if we check our privilege score when forming our views of social problems, we can be more aware, more informed, and less biased. And also that the appropriate response to privilege is not guilt, but to reach back and pull someone up. In Oxford, there was way more racial and ethnic diversity and a much higher level of education, so it looked very different. The focus there became more about the power of education and the importance of addressing barriers to education, etc., since the education leads to employment and empowerment. So it's neat how the exercise reflects the composition and current state of any given population." Close quote. Well, I like the way that Tony's response kind of moderates the tendency to go immediately into white guilt and shows a kind of a more nuanced response. Again, I applaud Tony and the partners that he works with in these workshops for their passion, commitment, and courage. They are such an example to us, and they present such a challenge. Finally, let me suggest that to learn more about Tony, his work, and his writings, you can go to tonycaldwell.net.
Hi, Dr. Dave. Tim here. I'm a psychologist from the Gold Coast, Australia. I was thinking recently it was about time I got off my butt and contributed some money to your wonderful program. It's given me so many hours of pleasure and education, especially on the drives to work. And I think it's important to support your mighty efforts, Dr. Dave. So I'd urge everyone out there to donate, contribute some money to make sure your show, very fine show, Shrink Wrap Radio, is around for a very long time. Okay, see you later.
Thanks, Tim, there on the Gold Coast of Australia. Even if you don't live on a Gold Coast, I hope you'll dig into your personal pile of gold and share a few micro grains of it here. If you're not already a financial supporter of Shrink Wrap Radio, won't you please join Tim by going to our website and clicking on the big support button in the right-hand sidebar. You'll feel so glad that you did, and so will I. We do have one new donor, and that's Patricia Preston. Thank you, Patricia. Okay, now I'm going to play the You Matter promo from last week this one last time, because I think it's such a deserving program. I want to give an unpaid plug to a worthy cause here. It's called the You Matter Marathon. But no running is required. The You Matter Marathon is creating and enriching positive connections between people and within communities. Last November, people from all 50 states and 59 countries shared 431,460 You Matter cards. This year, they're determined to share 1 million You Matter cards. The results are astounding. 61% of participants report that they achieve a greater sense of gratitude and enhanced connection with others. 51% report enhanced compassion for others, and 50% achieve enhanced levels of personal happiness. The lesson: one small gesture and two small words can help forge connections and spread kindness, compassion, and happiness. Now, this was started by a psychologist and motivational coach named Cheryl Rice, PhD. And she has created business-sized cards that say, "You Matter," on them. And she hands them out to people who she feels like maybe could use a little recognition. They might be a grocer. They might be somebody that she encounters on the street. And so this is a wonderful sort of positive initiative. So this global initiative, founded by Cheryl Rice, encourages positive connections between individuals and communities. And during November, individuals share these business-sized cards with only the words, "You Matter," on them. So if you or your organization is looking for a powerful way to build community and make a meaningful difference, consider participating in the You Matter Marathon. Now, there's a video on YouTube that illustrates this very dramatically, and you'll probably find a link to it at www.youmattermarathon.com, where you can get all the information about this program. And you, if you sign up, you will receive 30 pre-printed You Matter cards in the mail free, and you can join the Facebook card to connect with other You Matter marathoners and participants and to share progress and inspiring stories. To sign up, just go to www.youmattermarathon.com and get your free 30 You Matter cards while supplies last. By the way, this doesn't have to be restricted to November, so whenever you hear this message, this podcast, send off for your You Matter cards and just go ahead and distribute them. With that, I think we're going to wrap it up once again. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com, and you can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. And you can leave voicemail on our message phone at 415-830-4014. Thanks to today's guest, licensed clinical social worker and Jungian candidate, Tony Caldwell, for sharing with us his important work on racial and sexual justice. Next week, I'll be speaking with return guest Ruben Nyman about some new findings in relation to REM sleep. This will be the fourth time he's been on the show. I find him to be such an authority on sleep and dreaming that I'm always pleased to have him back. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.